So I have to confess, start with a confession, that when someone asked me the other day how I was feeling about giving the talk, I said I was feeling quite ambivalent. And it was the first time I'd voiced this sort of sense of unease, which was quite good to do, because I then realised that I had this little voice going on the back of my head saying I'm not the best person to give this talk. And I think it's partly that it's in the nature of friendship. It's in the nature of talking about spiritual friendship that it can sort of set off doubts and insecurities. That's part of it, the territory, if you like, that we all make mistakes in friendships. And I think thinking about this talk, my mind sort of was dwelling on times when I felt perhaps I hadn't been a very good friend, or I'd made various boo-boos or whatever, which is just part of the territory. It's very revealing, I think, and very humbling in a way, trying to be a good friend and having friends. But the other side of it, of course, is that it's got such... there are such riches, such a huge amount of joy and satisfaction and meaning in friendships for the good, spiritual friendships. So with both those sides, I'm just making an offering this morning. So the purpose of the series, just to introduce the series first, is to introduce some themes and general areas about spiritual friendship. And then later on in the year, we'll have other talks and workshops that will, some of them can be a little bit more interactive. For now, we're sort of laying out some of the territory. So we'll be covering some things specific to, or why have a year of Kalyana Mitrata, which is what we're doing at the centre, this 2013 year to focus on spiritual friendship, Kalyana Mitrata. What's so important about spiritual friendship? What's the difference between spiritual friendship and ordinary friendship, social friendship? What's the relationship between spiritual friend, spiritual friendship, and the Sangha as a whole? And what's the relationship between friendship and ethics? Very big area there. So those and more are some of the things we'll be addressing over the next few weeks. And I'll make a start this morning. For some of you, some of what's said this morning and other mornings will be quite well known to you. And for others, it will be much newer. But if it is well known to you, then it's always good to hear these things again, to, in a way, refresh what we already know. So it's helpful to just be quite open to things, even if we do have quite an understanding of what's been said. So just to give you a definition, and this is more or less Sangharakshita Bhante's definition of spiritual friendship. Kalyana, beautiful, charming, auspicious, helpful, and morally good. So there's a sense of spiritual loveliness in this word, Kalyana. And then Mitrata is generally translated as friend, as in Mitra, or friendship, Mitrata. So it can be beautiful friend, or more commonly, spiritual friendship. And we hear it all the time within our movement. We hear the Sangha talked about a lot, spiritual friendship talked about a lot. So we can. It's easy to think that we do understand what's being talked about. It's a big area, a big vision. And we have this very well-known saying that most of you will be very familiar with, of Ananda, this little interchange between Ananda and the Buddha. And Ananda all sort of flush with inspiration and saying to the Buddha, Lord, spiritual friendship is the half of the spiritual life. And the Buddha saying, say not so, Ananda. Spiritual friendship is the whole of the spiritual life. So in a sense, it's synonymous with the spiritual life. So it makes sense that there's more to Kalyanamitratta than we might initially think. Just hearing the word friendship, just even adding spiritual before it. And the year of Kalyanamitratta has come out of the council and some other order members wanting to mine some of these facets of spiritual friendship, sort of take them out and dust them off. There's a feeling that they could do with being dusted off, examined afresh and appreciating anew. Left to my own devices. Okay. So I've called this talk Truly, Madly, Deeply. Kalyanamitratta, Truly, Madly, Deeply. And as soon as I gave a title, I had another talk, more or less come fully sprung to mind, that was going to be a talk about spiritual friendship and sexual relationships. But that wasn't really appropriate for a more sort of introduction to the theme, introduction to the year. So maybe later in the year I'll get around to giving that particular talk. But I wanted to use this phrase, truly, madly, deeply. In a way, it sums up quite a lot about our culture, or an aspect of our culture. The romantic ideal is quite embedded in our culture. And in the time-honoured tradition of the Buddha, he would often use ideas that were in his sort of culture at the time, embedded in the culture, and give them a bit of a twist, give them his own sort of take, if you like. Use the ideas of contemporary spiritual teachers in this way. Co-opting words or symbols, particularly in relation to the Brahmins, who were the sort of, how would you call it, a sort of head of the, or saw themselves anyway as head of the sort of spiritual tree. So one of the things, the ways that he did this was the Brahmins were very keen on fire rituals, and this was linked with a sort of sacrificial element. So the Buddha would sort of turn this around, this symbol of fire in the Brahmin sense of being linked with sacrificial stuff. And he talked about greed, hatred and delusion as being fires, or craving being burning. The world is on fire with craving, burning. He also, in a way, to set against this culture of fire from the Brahmin or Hindu sense, he talked about nirvana as cooling. Lots and lots of words associated with nirvana that are to do with cooling, or letting fires go out, if you like. So I'm going to apply some these words of associated with a very romantic film, very good film, I thought, but very romantic film, to spiritual friendship, and we'll see what comes out. So, first point, I'm going to be taking quite a lot of what I say from Sangharakshita's ideas, talking about friendship. He makes the general point that we're all social beings. We've evolved in social groups, even those introverts amongst us. We've got a very long tradition of social interaction, being reliant on each other, to hunter-gatherers, to be in social groups. So we live in relationship to others, and we live in, if we're practicing, we live in spiritual relationship to others. And for us, that's in the form of a sangha, And I think we're incredibly lucky, incredibly fortunate to have a Sangha and the possibility of friends living a Dharma life. Other Sanghas, other Buddhist groups don't necessarily have this element well developed at all. We're quite unusual in that way to have such an emphasis on the Sangha and on then to have the possibility of all these benefits from having spiritual friends. It's perhaps hard for us to imagine, especially in a large centre like this one. But I think some smaller centres within Tri Ratna maybe have a little bit more of that experience. The number of people that they can become friends with are quite small. Sometimes that leads to very strong friendships, and sometimes it's more experienced in terms of limitations. But yeah, I think we are very fortunate to have such a large Sangha, and a Sangha that's continually growing, is continually having new people joining it. A bit like a lake that's continually being refreshed by this new springs, new perhaps underground springs coming into it. And without that continual growth, the Sangha would stagnate. Maybe just occasionally we get a sense, oh, it's really lovely, I've got my friends. But it probably wouldn't be lovely for a very long time without new people coming in, new ideas, new personalities, new possibilities. The Sangha is subject to impermanence and change like everything else. And in this case, I think it's a really good thing. So Sangha is the place where we learn to learn about Kalyanamitratā, learn about friendship with other practitioners, and we learn about what it means to have friends in this sense. So probably all of us, before we became Buddhists, had friends, and so we're aware that friendship's a natural expression of connection for us, and for most of us, our lives would be quite diminished without friends, whether spiritual friends or not. Our lives would be diminished by the lack of friends. So Bhante makes this distinction between social and spiritual friendship. Having come from we're all social beings. But spiritual friendship, the reason for the friendship is not primarily about enjoyment or pleasure. It's sharing values, common values, not based on sharing a good game of squash once in a while, or a coffee, or movies with a friend. Though, hopefully, with our spiritual friends, we do things that do give us pleasure and enjoyment. But it's much more based on common ideals, a joyful opportunity to share ourselves, to share what's most meaningful in our lives. So, I'll talk about, a little bit about truly, and talk about it more as truth, which is very familiar to us, the Dhamma, as truth. But also, within the Dhamma, within the truth, is what particularly speaks to us in a way, what points us back to truth. And some of you may have heard this before. I gave a talk a couple of years ago, I think, on Padmasambhava Day. And I talked about a story, a Tibetan detective story. And there's a little bit in it that's talking about living to be true, not to be old. Let's read you. So this is a lama in the book talking. I talked to a monk once who had spent years down below, he said, meaning the world outside the high ranges of Tibet. He had gone away light-hearted and came back full of sad news. He told me that many people had lost the way, that they ignored what was in their hearts because it was the safe way. He thought, incredible as it sounds, that there were millions of people down below who just wanted to live to be old, as if they were enslaved to their bodies. So then he goes on to talk a little bit about the consequences of that. And it's in a more sort of Tibetan context, or in the context of the story, what it means to be enslaved to their bodies. And he ends by saying, all because people just want to be old instead of being true. So I really like this. And it's a strong reminder for me of what the spiritual life is all about. Am I living my life oriented towards comfort, safety, avoiding challenges, staying true to the teachings of the Buddha, to my aspirations? It feels like there's a choice, almost in every moment, there's a choice there. And I think this phrase, living to be old, it sort of, in a way, it's the logical extension of taking the safe path, or not choosing in the moment, to perhaps do what needs to be done, or say what needs to be done, or to go meditate rather than watch another episode of my latest Fox set. There's all sorts of choices in all sorts of moments. So living to be old is just a reminder for me, is that what I want? Is that what I'm living my life for? How can I live my life to be true? So it reminds me of my purpose when I forget this particular phrase. So I think many moments of choice, old, true, choice, come in relation to others. Choice to point, if you like, true north, orienting towards greater freedom, freedom from habit, freedom of a creative response. Freedom that comes from acknowledging, well, this is how it is right now, rather than this is how I want it to be. I feel like struggling with how things are. And part of that is just allowing our friends to help us stay pointing north, if you like, pointing true. Allowing them to help us see our blind spots, and gently point them out to us. To have a dialogue, to be able to dialogue with our friends. So one of the ways of looking at spiritual friendship is authentic communication. So we do our best to be ourselves, to be true to ourselves, to open up to others, without taking on a role, which is often we're in the role of a parent, or the role of a child, we're in the role of a boss, but in the spiritual community, ideally we're just ourselves, just able to be ourselves, able to take risks in communication, and able to talk about our practice, to be willing to explore that inner world with others. So Bhante asks several things, a couple of questions. He says, do we rejoice and take delight in the spiritual beauty of our friends? I think this is a really lovely way of putting it. It's easy to fall into, they're just so-and-so, we know them. But actually to just bring in that bigger picture, knowing and taking delight in their spiritual beauty, the spiritual qualities in our friends. Then Bhante talks about knowing that we're known in our beauty and in our ugliness. So I think this is really important, this sense of being known. I think it really aids connection and works against feelings that are quite sort of prevalent in our society of isolation, of separation from others. Perhaps being on the edge of things, on the edge of a group. So being known. in both senses, our beauty and our ugliness. And in terms of acknowledging our spiritual beauty, Auntie recommends positive feedback, recommends really rejoicing in our merits. And he suggests that if someone rejoices in your merits, if you could say to them in return, rather than being a bit sort of bashful or a bit modest, just say, "I'm glad you noticed." In a very sort of very simple way, but that's quite something, isn't it? It's hard to do, even in a jokey way. But just it suggests that we're aware of our own riches, our own beauty, and we're happy to own those things. And then there's the other side. There's the ugliness. Which might come in terms of everyday sort of pettiness or irritation or clumsiness in communication. But knowing that our friends still appreciate us, they can still see us in a more sort of whole way. And it can be quite a relief to be seen in that way, to be known, to be seen. I mean, I've talked about the little pettinesses, but sometimes there are really, really big things that play on our minds. Perhaps things that we've never told anybody else. And they might not be that bad, but to us, there's an awful lot of shame, or there's a lot that we sort of, a secretiveness around this particular thing. And it can just really, really help and be a very significant step, I think, in a spiritual friendship to confide. Perhaps in just one person. And it can really help to sort of shift and let go of the sense of shame that we're not good enough. So having at least one person knowing our worst can be very, very helpful. I think one of the things that really helps is that we can develop inner resources to acknowledge, confess and apologise quite promptly for some of those smaller things. So then the air is cleared much more quickly with our friends, and it stays a sort of clear stream, if you like, rather than being sort of muddied with all sorts of unspoken, just small things, but they add up over time. So inevitably there are disappointments, betrayals, fallouts in friendships, and it's really painful when disappointed expectations, when our friend falls short of our ideals, when we fall short in communication. So I think it's part of getting to know ourselves, how we deal with it when someone disagrees with us, when they criticise us, when they let us down, or get angry with us, or the other way around. So I think this self-knowledge can be very helpful. And the communication and the friendship that builds in this process can be part of maturing, spiritual maturing. A very long time ago, some of you have heard this story, I worked in the Cherry Orchard restaurant in London. And there were a lot of us, and we were very new to spiritual practice at the time. We were mostly in our mid-20s. And things were very exciting at times and very inspiring, and at other times it all went to pot. And there were various fallings out. And at one point, one of the women who worked there, she said it was a bit like we were in one of those machines where you put a lot of sort of really rough-edged stones and you put them in the machine in a way to let the stones rub each other's rough sides off. So they come out really smooth and beautiful and with a certain sort of polish on them. And she said it was a bit like we were all in this machine working in this intensive situation in the Cherry Orchard and the on-off button had broken. So we were basically getting all this sort of rattling around. But we hadn't yet come out. We hadn't yet come out the other side with this spiritual maturation. But I think one of the things to bear in mind is that this side of stream entry, our side, most of our sides anyway, we're not reliable. We will let people down and they will let us down. And I find that really helpful to bear in mind. And that forgiveness is part of spiritual friendship. So can we cultivate the kindness, patience, forgiveness and honesty necessary towards ourselves? Learn to see ourselves and our friends as work in progress. Remembering that we're all imperfect human beings. Sometimes when somebody else is really getting on our nerves, it's hard to remember that we too are imperfect. And just that little remembering can make all the difference. So authentic communication, an integral part of spiritual friendship. True communication. So I want to talk a little bit about madly. So there's a word in Pali, majja. I think that's how you say it, M-A-J-J-A, majja. It means mad. And in certain contexts, it's also alludes to intoxication and maddening. So in the Pali canon, madness or words madly, mad, maddening, pop up quite a lot, more than you might expect. They often talk about the mind being mad, the mad mind. And there's a particular sutta on impermanence that says, though change again and again speaks to them and makes them unhappy, they pursue their mad career of whirling around the wheel of existence. So it's very much a sense of worldlings, all worldlings, worldlings. That's us, are mad. That's said quite often. On the other side of it, it's said, and I couldn't find a reference for this, so it's possible it's something Sangharakshita said. I couldn't find a reference in the Pali Canon. It's said that if the Buddha would appear in the world, we would perceive him as a fool or a madman. I think there's one of the things. That's how most people would perceive the Buddha, as being a madman or a fool. So an object of misunderstanding, even of ridicule. And there's a glimpse in this with the first person that the Buddha meets after his enlightenment. And he sort of tells him, the man says, why do you look so radiant and so serene? And he says, well, I'm the enlightened one. I'm awakened. I'm the Buddha. And this guy says, oh. Good for you, mate. And on he walks. There's a sense of perhaps not taking the Buddha quite seriously, certainly not sort of understanding what he's saying. And someone else who I read about a number of years ago, a man called Eckhart Tolle, who had a spiritual, some sort of spiritual awakening. And for 2 years after that, he spent 2 years on park benches. And when I first read this, I thought it meant that he lived as a homeless person on park benches for 2 years. I think maybe that wasn't the case. He just perhaps did a lot of sitting on benches in parks. But at the time, it freaked me out. I thought, if that's what enlightenment does, I'm not sure that I want it. Let's go around the other side. So I think I found it very challenging, the idea of being seen as someone so much on the edge of society, an object of pity. Maybe one of those teenagers who are quite scathing might even call me a loser. Or being a bit like someone a bit odd, like maybe the naked rambler. So I think my ego sort of reared up. I think there is something about renunciation of how one is seen. But I think I missed the point a bit. But I think the point that is relevant is the radical nature of what we're engaged in and how different the Buddha's perspective of right view is to our own conditioning, our own conditioned views. I think it's very important to see how countercultural or counterintuitive sometimes the Dharma is. And this expresses itself in our own Dharma community. I think things have changed a lot, but when I first came along, it was weird actually to be vegetarian, and it was weird to meditate 28 years ago. So that's changed. Though in some ways, my dad still thinks that I don't have a proper job, predominantly because I don't earn a good enough salary to be able to have a mortgage. And he's always thought that I just go on lots of holidays. He just insists that retreats are holidays. So there's ways that there's still ways that I feel like I don't really fit in, or that sort of that there's the radical edge is there. But I want to give you three examples of values, perhaps where the Dharma is more sort of counter-cultural or counter-intuitive to culture. So one of them is metta mode rather than power mode. So we're not trying to get what we want regardless of others. I think metta is a radical and an incredibly sane response to the human predicament. Dukkha is everywhere. We're all in the same boat. We will all get old, sick, and die. And whether we feel at the end of that we've lived to be old or we've lived to be true, that's up to us. But metta can break down the barriers that create difference, separation, opposition. So within friendship, metta is really helpful and important. At a recent class I was leading, I think I was teaching the Metta Bhavana, and I read a poem called The Chance to Love Everything by Mary Oliver. And I primarily read this poem because of the title, because I think it's such an amazing notion, and what a privilege, if you like. This simple practice opens us up to the possibility of cultivating love without limits. The possibility of, rather than our usual sort of small circle of family, of friends, people that are in our circle for positive regard. Yeah, we've got the chance to love everything, everyone. And the thing is, we practice on each other. So we're the recipients of attempts to communicate with metta. So metta is at the core of our practice and our relationships with each other, and it can really help us develop trust. Trust in each other's good intentions. So even when things are really difficult, and perhaps a friend has gone into the fourth stage of the metta, we still have metta as a tool to help rebuild relationships, to help see them in a sort of broader, more kindly context. And I think they help build stronger relationships, stronger friendships. I think that can sometimes come, I suppose it's the mixture of a difficulty and bringing metta to it. So you've got these two things, fourth stage person, and you've got metta. And I think it's a bit like the process of when you exercise, and in exercise to have benefits, you have to push yourself a bit. You have to push, and actually that process involves your muscles tearing and breaking down to some extent, not too much, but just to some extent, and then they heal, and they are stronger than they were before, just on a physiological level. I was going to tell you about my good friend Gunasiddhi, but I don't really have time, so I'll just mention her. She's my oldest friend in the movement, nearly 28 years. So I want to talk a bit, the second thing, to do with a counter-cultural value, is the hierarchical nature of spiritual friendship and spiritual community. So I think often hierarchy is quite a difficult thing for us. It's often not a positive thing. Our society is quite egalitarian, quite liberal, sometimes anti-hierarchical. Maybe in response to the class system, probably in response to other things. So I think that the fact that there is an element of hierarchy within spiritual friendship challenges us to emotionally clarify our relationship to authority. This is a really big area of conditioning for us to come into relationship with. Strong feelings involved. And either we can be a little bit passive, a little bit conforming, go along with things, a sort of doctor knows best sort of attitude, or we can resist or fight perceived authority. I know this in myself as don't tell me what to do. So usually we have both responses. But the spiritual hierarchy is not about authority in this sense of power. Or even some sort of automatic respect. I had a very interesting conversation with a friend of mine who's a Theravada nun. Seniority in her tradition, it's the Thai, well, the English Sangha Trust, or Thai Sangha Trust. In her tradition, seniority is by the number of vasas that you've been in robes for. And vasas are the rainy season. So basically, it's a number of years that you've been in robes and you're deemed to be, unless you're a woman, of course, but that's a whole other story. you're deemed to be the most superior if you've got the most number of years under your belt. And this is even acted out in when they go on alms round or when they sort of are walking all together somewhere. They do it in order of seniority. So it's a very simple way of expressing sort of spiritual hierarchy. But it's not based on spiritual values. It's based on how long you've been ordained. So I was telling her about how it's not like that for us, and she was very, very interested in it. I was saying, I was using Subhuti as an example. I was saying there's this order member called Subhuti. He's been around a very long time. He's been ordained a long time. But even though he's been ordained a very long time, and a lot of people do sort of love him and respect him, it's not because he's been ordained a very long time. It's because of who he is. The respect or the love that he's offered is based on who he is. And you know, he is quite a visible order member, so who he is quite visible, and some people don't like it as well as people who do like it. But primarily, I feel really happy that our sense of spiritual hierarchy or spiritual authority is based on some sort of communication with someone, whether that's through reading their books, whether that's through a personal communication or a talk. But it's the quality of communication that leads to a sense of respect, a sense of receptivity, a sense of there's something I can learn, or something I really value about this person. So ideally we have a range of friendships within the Sangha. Peer friendships, sometimes called horizontal friendships. I think they're really important. Really important to have friends who are exploring similar things to ourselves at a similar sort of place, maybe in a study group or on a course you're taking. I think peer friendships were really important to me through classes, work and community. I lived in a small community for a number of years. And also for regular retreats. I think going on retreats can really broaden a sense of Sangha and community. And I've got some friends who are still, that I met on retreat in those very early days. It also really helped that when some of my peer friends got ordained, that helped me feel I had friends in the order and led to me getting ordained. But spiritual hierarchy, yeah, includes this element of vertical friendship. Someone who's been practicing. They may have been practicing longer than we have. We might have a formalized relationship, a Kalyana Mitra relationship with that person. We may not, it may be quite informal, but there's still the sense that of receptivity in relation to them. They can model the path for us. And sometimes that's through, there's a clear link to, well, they've been meditating more years than us, or they've reflected and studied the Dharma for longer than us. But sometimes it might be just that they apologize more quickly than us. You know, there's a seeing the value of a clear conscience and of clear in communication with someone. So at this point, they can seem a little bit further along the path from us, but that changes. It's not static. I think something about spiritual hierarchy, it's not a static thing. So the third aspect of this is an altruistic dimension of practice. So other regarding. And this altruism goes back to the Buddha's decision to teach, even though he thought he would find it a bit vexing at times. People wouldn't understand him. Bhante recommends something I think is quite profound. He says, don't think about getting friends, but about being a friend. Don't think about having or getting friends, but about being a friend. I think this cuts through all this anxiety we can have at times. I don't have any friends. I don't have enough friends. He's so popular, busy. How can I possibly approach him? Ask her for a cup of tea. So we can think about being a friend and someone, I won't say who it is, embarrass her, but someone I think was quite exemplary in this way about a year ago to me. She said, I'd like to get to know you, and I'd like to do that by helping you at the centre in some way. And even though we've ended up not working together that directly in the way that we initially thought we would, I was extremely touched by this. And actually it is leading to a developing of a friendship. But it came from that initial dual impulse to want to be a friend and offering what she could see that I needed at the time. So I think the centre as a place to enact the altruistic dimension of spiritual friendship, it's here. We can use it. We can use it by growing new friendships or seeding a culture of friendship through reaching out to people who are quite new to the centre, being on a class team where you just get to know people. It's very inspiring being in touch with people at different phases of their relationship with the centre. So I'm running out of time, so I'm speeding up a little bit. So I want to talk about this aspect of deeply or deepening. So deepening spiritual friendship and creating sangha, deepening our relationship with our own practice. So altruism is not about what we get, but what we give. So dana, I think, is really, really important. But even though altruism is not about getting, but giving, I think that sentence can be a bit misleading, because it can lead us to think that giving is a bit painful and it's going against what we really want. I think dana can get a bit stuck when it's seen in that way. There's a bit of resistance to giving. Then there's a